The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I'll be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That's spelled G-S-U-G-G-S-Insurance.com, or call 919-875-8888. The issue that I'll be reading from today is dated December 14, 2020. It is the only one available to us at this time. And it is Time in broad capital letters with a light gray print on white background. The usual red border around the front cover. And centered in very large, bold black print is 2020 with a bright red X across it, and it says the worst year ever. Beginning then with the page entitled Conversation. What you said about the COVID winter, after reading Jamie Ducharme's November 30, December 7 cover story on the potential for a COVID-19 surge this winter, readers marveled at how America could have ended up in such a predicament. The most depressing cover ever, wrote Colleen Badenhop of Beaver Creek, Ohio, of the frosty windowpane warning created for Time by London-based artists Sean Freeman and Eve Steven. Enrique Puertos of Cleveland, Georgia, argued that the spread of COVID-19 misinformation was as alarming as the spread of the virus itself. Social media platforms are the super spreaders, he wrote. The callous attitude of a sizable section of people toward this life-threatening pandemic has led to a disturbing trend of conscious ignorance, added Preetish Day of Waukesha, Wisconsin, when we actually need to be together, take precautions, and collectively fight this pandemic. Readers were also attuned to how the pandemic has accentuated the pain and sadness of all our losses this past year, singular and collective. Louis Bloom of Los Angeles said he will never forget W.J. Hennigan's so well-researched feature on a woman's journey to burial on New York City's Heart Island, where a mass graveyard for unclaimed or unidentified corpses is situated. And Debbie Klein of Milford, Connecticut, said Nicole Chung's op-ed on mourning her mother during the pandemic articulated everything she felt losing her own mother this past spring and offered hope to others in their position. The essay will hit home with thousands of people as we have navigated and continue to do so through these trying times. The human spirit is resilient. We will get through this. There are better days ahead. And one more quote appears in the middle of the page. Wearing a mask is smart. Gripers who balk should be given a choice, a mask or a dunce cap. That was from Chase Webb of Portland, Oregon. For the record is the next page we visit. Otherwise, I'll see you in 4 years, front and center in big bold print. President Donald Trump seemingly teasing a 2024 presidential run after his loss to President-elect Joe Biden in the 2020 election, which he continues to contest at a White House Christmas party, December 1. I have piles of cash at home. The government's paying me cash for my salary because I don't have a bank account. Carrie Lam, L-A-M. Hong Hong Kong's chief executive, explaining in a November 27 interview how she circumvents U.S. sanctions. 9 is the numeral in red letters. 9 days between the discovery of a mysterious metallic monolith in the Utah desert and its equally mysterious disappearance, November 27. The more I hold myself close and fully embrace who I am, the more my heart grows and the more I thrive. Elliot Page, the Juno and Umbrella Academy actor coming out as trans in a December 1 statement. I say thank you from the bottom of my heart. For the first time in more than 4 years, I breathe freedom and liberty today. General Michael Flynn, who twice pled guilty to lying to the FBI, responding November 26 to a sweeping pardon from President Trump. 427,300 total number of employees hired by Amazon between January and October, growing its workforce by more than 50% from 2019. Good news of the week. Remember, this was the week of December 14, please. Cavan, K-A-A-V-A-N, the world's loneliest elephant, moved from Pakistan's Margajar Zoo to a Cambodian wildlife sanctuary November 30, after a campaign led by Cher to free him from conditions many had labeled cruel and painful. The brief opener is the title of this page. It's a one-page article, Health, What the COVID-19 Vaccines Actually Do, by Alice Park. It's a rare glimmer of hope in a brutal and battering pandemic year. In November, both Moderna and Pfizer BioNTech reported their much-anticipated COVID-19 vaccines are around 95% effective in protecting people against getting sick with the disease. Both companies requested authorization from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration to start distributing vaccines, and the agency was expected to review those requests in mid-December. Scientists are encouraged and even surprised by the magnitude of the protection. Public health officials finally see what could be the beginning of the end of the pandemic. Families everywhere are fantasizing about a return to normality, where gathering to celebrate holidays is not a matter of public health concern. But those same public health experts also warn vaccines are not the panacea that many desperately hope they will be. That is because for now studies show that rather than preventing a person from getting infected, the shots appear to keep people from getting dangerously sick. It is a distinction that is easily lost in the discussion of efficacy. Moderna and Pfizer BioNTech reported their shots are 94.1% and 95% effective, respectively. But at this point, efficacy does not refer to the vaccine's ability to prevent infection with the virus, but rather to its ability to protect against the disease the virus causes, COVID-19. In both trials, volunteers were randomly given either the vaccine or a placebo, then asked to report any symptoms of COVID-19, such as fever, cough, shortness of breath, or muscle aches. Only then were they tested for the presence of the virus. If people tested positive, they were logged as confirmed COVID-19 cases. Later, researchers compared how many in the positive group had been vaccinated versus how many had gotten a placebo, and found that those who'd been vaccinated were more likely to experience fewer symptoms and not get as sick as those on the placebo. Because the study homed in on just those volunteers who tested positive, there is no way to tell for sure whether the vaccinations confer total immunity for anyone else. What is clear is that the vaccine appears to protect you from getting sicker once you are infected, and that is still a huge advantage over the virus, as severe COVID-19 can send people to intensive care. The more infected people who experience milder symptoms and recover at home, the less burden there is on the healthcare system, and the less exposure that healthcare workers will have to the virus, all of which contributes to better control of the pandemic. However, because the vaccines do not necessarily protect against infection, we won't be abandoning public health measures such as wearing masks, social distancing, and avoiding indoor gatherings anytime soon. Researchers are still studying whether people who are vaccinated and never experience symptoms can still spread the disease to others. In the meanwhile, experts say it is best to keep up the behaviors that have proven to stymie the spread of COVID-19. When the shots are authorized, initial supplies will be limited until manufacturing can match demand. An independent committee of advisors to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, recommended December 1 that healthcare workers and older residents in long-term care facilities, both of whom are at higher risk of getting COVID-19, should be vaccinated first. The CDC has also asked state health departments to submit proposals for how they'll distribute doses in phases. Not all of these plans have been solidified, but most start with high-risk groups and then move to more vulnerable populations, including people with chronic health conditions, and eventually everyone else as more doses become available over the next few months. While both companies have begun producing doses, it is likely the majority of Americans will not be vaccinated until next spring at the earliest. So the ultimate goal in controlling the pandemic, herd immunity, probably will not happen until well into next year, referring to now this year, 2021. Not until a substantial proportion of the population is vaccinated and the caseload has dropped to very low levels will we be able to breathe without a mask a sigh of relief, says Emmanuel Goldman, professor of microbiology at Rutgers University. And even then, he points out, researchers will have to remain vigilant about tracking any changes in the virus. It might have other ideas and try to change in a way that makes the vaccine less effective. Only by vaccinating millions of people and monitoring how their immune systems react will experts get a better handle on what it takes to extinguish COVID-19, or at least make it much more difficult for it to spread. The big message is that we have an additional tool in the form of vaccines for fighting COVID-19, but we do not yet have a tool to replace everything we do just yet, says Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. Hopefully, as the country and world gets massively vaccinated, this virus will be essentially backed in, with no place to go because everybody's protected. Dr. Fauci is photographed here in an inset. It is a full-body photo. He's wearing a gray suit, a blue shirt, and some kind of a blue pattern tie, dark brown shoes. He has gray, almost white hair, and in this photo he is wearing a black mask. Ellis Park has the byline to this article with a reporting by Amy Gunia, Hong Kong. News ticker. Pope installs first African-American cardinal. That happened November 28 when Pope Francis appointed 13 new cardinals in a Vatican City ceremony. The Archbishop of Washington, D.C., Wilton Gregory, 72, became the first African-American cardinal in the Catholic Church's history. Australia's Army acts after a report of abuses. 13 Special Forces soldiers face dismissal after an independent commission's report on unlawful killings in Afghanistan, the Australian Army's head said November 27. The Brereton report alleges troops were involved in the murders of 39 Afghan civilians and prisoners from 2005 to 2013. Thai protesters face leger majeste charges. On November 30, five leaders of Thailand's pro-democracy protest movement reported to police to face charges under a law that ostensibly protects the country's monarchy from insult. But that's become a political weapon. Protesters carrying inflatable ducks, a symbol of the movement, continue marching in Bangkok to demand accountability. Here's a photograph. It shows a rustic scene. There's a tree and more foliage in front of a rock wall. The top of the rock wall is in layers and shades of gray to white to green to tan. And the lower part of the rock wall has paintings on it in a very rusty, rustic fashion. Prehistoric paintings is the caption. A vast collection of ancient rock art has been discovered on cliff faces deep in the Colombian Amazon, providing further evidence the rainforest's earliest human inhabitants lived alongside now extinct Ice Age animals. Likely created up to 12,500 years ago, the drawings were first discovered by a team of British and Colombian archaeologists in 2019, but had been kept secret till now, ahead of their debut in a documentary set to air in the United Kingdom. It's difficult to describe what the paintings depict, but one does see animals. The shapes of the animals remind me perhaps of boar, and some have longer necks. Perhaps they were supposed to be something like antelope or gazelle with long spread out legs. Then there are a lot of geometric shapes, zigzags, and more squarish zigzag patterns, squares with crisscrosses and dots, perhaps depicting fields. It is just an interesting and very rustic reminder of what has been found in this jungle habitat. The coloration on the whitish-gray rock, which is amazing in itself because surely it has been exposed to erosion over a thousand or more years, it's a deep, dark red, a crimson, a reddish-brown, almost a rust color. And there are several layers of these horizontal, and one doesn't know if they were red from left to right or right to left, paintings and drawings. And now I'm seeing something that looks like long-necked geese or waterfowl. All kinds of creatures are depicted here. I'm not seeing any human figures, but perhaps some of what I would consider an animalistic or anthropomorphic figure is supposed to be a human. Moving now to the bulletin with a few paragraphs. In France, a debate over filming police. By the time the canister flew through a window, filling the room with tear gas, a security camera had already captured footage that would convulse France. It showed three Paris police officers violently assaulting Michel Declerc, a black musician. Declerc says the three officers, whom his colleagues pushed outside moments before a fourth fired the canister, used racial slurs. The November 21 incident is the most recent example of police brutality against minorities in France, and an outcry has ensued, just as the country's government is pushing for stricter law enforcement powers. France has faced waves of sometimes violent protests in recent years, from 2018's Yellow Vest movement to racial injustice demonstrations this past summer. In response, lawmakers on November 24 gave early approval to a new bill backed by President Emmanuel Macron that would in some cases make it illegal to share videos or photos of police. The government said the law was vital to protect officers from extremists. Liberté, Égalité, but rights groups argue the law would harm freedom of the press and make videos like the one of Zeclair's assault less likely to surface. November 28, tens of thousands of people took to the streets of Paris and other cities to protest the legislation and the larger issue of police brutality. Some protesters wore T-shirts demanding justice for Adama Traoré, a black man who died in police custody in 2016. By November 30, Macron had been forced to backtrack. His party announced lawmakers would completely rewrite an article in the bill about filming police. Meanwhile, four officers have been charged with Sinclair's assault and fabrication of evidence. They deny allegations they used racial slurs. Watchdogs said the rewrite was welcome but not enough. Fixing French policing means addressing systemic racism and ethnic profiling, not just tinkering around the edges of one article, of one piece of legislation, said Kartik Raj, a researcher at Human Rights Watch. That short article was written by Billy Perigo. The Brief Milestones. Tony Hsu died, and that last name is spelled, and hopefully I pronounced it closely to being correct, H-S-I-E-H. Visionary CEO Who Delivered Happiness by Alfred Lin, L-I-N. Tony Hsu and I first met at a Harvard party in 1992. We bonded over outlandish business ideas like his plan to run our dorm's food joint. Except then Tony did just that. He transformed Quincy House Grill by adding a pizza oven, arcade games, and a foosball table. He would move on to make many profound contributions to the world as an entrepreneur, from web advertising with Link Exchange to e-commerce with Zappos. Through all this serious work, Tony never took himself too seriously. After one meeting, he asked board members to join employees for a Macarena dance-off. Tony died November 27, over Thanksgiving weekend. His tradition for the holiday was always to invite lots of people over, especially those without a place to go. He often referred to himself as the caboose. Everyone else came first. The world will laud Tony for his professional achievements, but those of us who were blessed to know him will remember him for connecting people from all walks of life and bringing joy to others. Alfred Lin, who wrote the article, is a partner at Sequoia Capital. He and she work together at Link Exchange, Venture Frogs, and Zappos. Died Diego Maradona. Touched by the hand of God. Diego Maradona, that's spelled M-A-R-A-D-O-N-A, is about to dribble through two English defenders in the quarterfinals of the 1986 World Cup. He spins, however, somehow keeping the ball attached to his left foot as if it were a toy, and he the child who won't let it go. And then he's off to finish arguably the greatest 70-yard charge in soccer history. England's goalkeeper, Peter Shilton, is the last line of defense. Maradona, who died at 60 of a heart attack November 25, shimmies to his right and Shilton slides right past him, giving Maradona the goal and Argentina the 2-0 lead it would hold on to en route to the country's second World Cup title. His greatest achievement, that goal, will forever live in my memory, says Telemundo broadcaster Andres Cantor, who's called every World Cup since 1990. Maradona netted that most jaw-dropping goal in World Cup history minutes after scoring the most controversial one. Argentina first took the lead after his illegal handball. "A little with the head of Maradona and a little with the hand of God," he said later. He had demons. Maradona struggled with addiction, but he will be remembered for his magic. On the day he died, a sad silence enveloped Buenos Aires. He is the greatest player of all time, Cantor says, an artist. Poetry in Motion. Sean Gregory wrote that article. Died, a few more people here noted. David Dinkins, New York City's first and only black mayor from 1990 to 93, November 23 at 93. Bruce Boynton, a civil rights icon who inspired 1961's freedom rides and plaintiff in the landmark Supreme Court case, Boynton v. Virginia, November 23 at 83. Pat Patterson, WWE wrestler, executive, and Royal Rumble creator, December 2 at 79. Resigned controversial presidential advisor Dr. Scott Atlas, November 30, having joined President Trump's coronavirus task force in August. Defected, a North Korean man, reportedly a former gymnast, who escaped to South Korea by scaling a 10-foot fence in the DMZ, a November 24 report said. Sentenced, Hong Kong pro-democracy activist Joshua Wong to 13 and a half months in prison, December 2, after he pleaded guilty to a charge of inciting a 2019 protest at police headquarters. Charged, Jerry Boylan, the California captain of a dive boat that caught fire in 2019, killing 34, with 34 counts of seaman's manslaughter, December 1. One, that's W-O-N, Claire, a Scottish deerhound, who was named Best in Show at 2020's National Dog Show, November 26, over some 600 other dogs. From the brief news, this is subtitled Nation. Is student loan forgiveness unforgivable? In Congress. Even before taking office, President-elect Joe Biden's already facing a political storm among his ideologically diverse base of supporters over the volatile issue of student debt forgiveness. Roughly 45 million Americans currently hold $1.6 trillion in student debt, with the average student loan recipient owing between $20,000 and $25,000, according to the Federal Reserve. Among those actively making payments on their debt, the average monthly installment is between $200 and $300. And with 5.3 million more people unemployed than in February, right before the U.S. fell into a pandemic-induced recession, progressives say student debt forgiveness could be a boon for the economy. Student debt cancellation feels like one of the most accessible executive actions to stimulate the economy at the moment, says Suzanne Kahn, director of the Education, Jobs, and Worker Power Program and the Great Democracy Initiative at the Liberal Roosevelt Institute. Kahn and the others say the move would also help close the wealth gap between white Americans and people of color. Some 90% of black students and 72% of Latino students take out loans for college versus just 66% of white students, according to a 2016 analysis from the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. But the more moderate faction of Biden's base argues that sweeping student loan forgiveness does not help the people who need aid most. Americans with college degrees as a whole have been less devastated by the economic effects of COVID-19 than their non-college educated counterparts. A September report from Pew Research Center found only 12% of people with college degrees were having trouble paying bills as a result of the pandemic, compared with 34% of Americans with a high school diploma or less. Others raise concerns about precedent. If the government wipes out current student loans, future college students may have an incentive to take on debts, they argue, hoping they will also be forgiven. colleges may in turn be inclined to raise their prices further. In recent weeks, Biden's walked a fine line on the issue, offering support for a bill from House Democrats calling for $10,000 worth of student loan forgiveness, but stopping short of endorsing anything close to a plan championed by Senators Elizabeth Warren and Chuck Schumer to issue $50,000 per borrower through executive action. What is clear, according to experts on both sides of the aisle, is that economic crises exacerbate the problem of student debt. The last time the U.S. dipped into a recession, state governments cut their investments in colleges and universities, which in turn raised their tuition prices and forced students to take on ever larger loans. That is not sustainable in the long run. It remains to be seen if Biden can arrive at a political solution that is. That was written by Abby Vesoulis. Crime, return service. An anonymous woman mailed a piece of marble back to Rome's National Roman Museum in November, apologizing for being an American A-hyphen-hyphen-hole by taking it from an ancient site in the city. Here, more regretful thieves. These few paragraphs by Madeline Carlisle. Hieroglyph Hex, an unnamed man, delivered a carving back to the Egyptian embassy in Berlin in 2007, claiming his stepfather had stolen the item while in Egypt 3 years earlier and had suffered the curse of the pharaohs. Stolen stone. In March, a man returned to the Israel Antiquities Authority a 2,000-year-old ballista taken from a display in Jerusalem 15 years earlier, saying he wanted to clear his conscience before the end of the world. Roman ruins. A Canadian tourist returned 5 artifacts to the archaeological park of Pompeii in October, saying she'd stolen them in 2005. She added that she'd also had bad luck ever since and did not want to pass the curse to her family. From the news ticker, 3 short items. Ethiopian troops gain control of Tigray capital. Federal forces took control of Mekelle, the Tigray region's capital, Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed tweeted November 28 after a period of fierce fighting in and around the city. Ethiopia's military for weeks has been locked in conflict with the Tigray People's Liberation Front. India's farmers bring protests to Delhi. Demonstrations against new agriculture laws in Delhi swelled November 30 as tens of thousands of farmers blocked roads with tractors and trailers. Protesters say the pro-market reforms passed by Prime Minister Narendra Modi's government leave them vulnerable to exploitation. Biden-Harris approved for presidential daily briefings. President-elect Joe Biden and Vice-President-elect Kamala Harris began receiving the president's daily intelligence briefings November 30, a key step in the transition of power that typically starts shortly after an election, but was delayed by the Trump administration as the president disputed states' results, or continues to. This is entitled Light Box. I don't know why it's called Light Box, because the subtitle is Death of Dish. The lens of the camera from above, I don't know if it's from a helicopter or airplane, shows a jungle. Dense, 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 very, very, very green foliage. But there is a tower, a concrete tower, rising out of the jungle. And next to the tower, there's a broken hemisphere of concrete. It's all crackly in the middle. There's a big fence around the perimeter, but it's all crackled and mashed in the middle. And it's called Death of Dish. It was with no shortage of sorrow that the astronomical world learned December 1, the Arecibo Observatory in Puerto Rico collapsed, its 900-ton receiver platform tumbling into its reflecting dish, demolishing both the observatory itself and any hopes that the venerable instrument could somehow be saved. Completed in 1963, Arecibo long served to study gravitational waves, pulsars, and planets circling distant stars, and to scan the skies for rogue asteroids. It was also featured in movies, including GoldenEye and Contact, but hurricanes, earthquakes, and a series of accidents in which support cables snapped pushed it over the edge, said Angel Vasquez, the telescope's director of operations, to the Associated Press. It was too much for the old girl to take. The photograph is by Ricardo Arduengo, AFP Getty Images. Unfortunately, this article does not relate the size of this dish, which is probably massive based upon the fact that the jungle surrounding it is massive. The risk report. A ray of hope for Iran after a brutal year, by Ian Bremmer. A terrible year for Iran got worse when the country's top nuclear scientist was killed. As the architect of Iran's nuclear weapons program, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh was, I'll spell that, Fakhrizadeh, was a national hero, and his November 27 assassination has ignited fury across the country. Iran's foreign ministry and state media were quick to pin blame on Israel. 2020 began with the U.S. assassination in Iraq of General Qasem Soleimani, one of Iran's most powerful men, which was soon followed by Iran's military accidentally shooting down a passenger plane, setting off a round of anti-government protests. Then came COVID-19. Iran became the first coronavirus hotspot outside East Asia, as Iranian officials lied about the severity of the outbreak to protect voter turnout for parliamentary elections that boosted hand-picked, hardline candidates. Bungling by the government set off more demonstrations, and many more Iranians died than the government acknowledged. The economic toll grew heavier when the pandemic forced down the global prices of oil and natural gas, vital Iranian exports. In July, a fire at Iran's most important nuclear fuel enrichment site, which officials blamed on a bomb planted by Israel, inflicted enough damage to delay Iran's nuclear program by months. Nor can Iran be pleased to see its two main enemies, Israel and Saudi Arabia, taking steps toward better relations. According to Israeli officials, Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu met with U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo in November, though the Saudis deny it happened. The meeting is historic, even if they have little in common beyond a mutual need for regional stability and a shared antipathy toward Iran. But Iran also got some much-needed good news when Joe Biden won the presidential election. Now there's reason for hope among those in Iran who desperately want the U.S. to return to the nuclear deal and the economic relief it might bring if sanctions are eased. With a presidential election in Iran this year and Iran's hardliners working to undermine President Hassan Rouhani, Iran's negotiators will not want to look weak at the table. But Rouhani knows Biden's top diplomat, Tony Blinken, and National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan are veterans of the Obama administration negotiations that made the original deal in 2015. This timing helps explain why Israel might have moved to kill the nuclear scientist now. Donald Trump's still president. Any displeasure from the incoming Biden team can be managed at the very least. Iran's nuclear program has likely been set back once again. Israel has been blamed for killing Iranian scientists in the past, though none of Fakhrizadeh's stature. Perhaps Israel's hoping Iran's hardliners will persuade the supreme leader to try to launch a showy retaliatory attack that will make it much more difficult for the Biden administration to re-enter the nuclear deal. But the timing also helps explain why Iran's retaliation will be measured carefully to avoid escalation. Biden represents the one hope Iran has of getting its economy back on track anytime soon. Iran's accusations that Israel killed Fakhrizadeh are made plausible by the sophistication of the attack, and therein lies a worrisome sign of things to come. It appears the nuclear scientist and his security detail were attacked with a remote-controlled machine gun. It's the kind of lethal autonomous weapon we are used to seeing in movies. New technologies, particularly the increasing sophistication of drone aircraft, will make asymmetric warfare more common and more effective. Quick Talk is the title of this column. David Beasley, the UN's global hunger chief. Beasley is the executive director of the World Food Program, the UN agency in charge of food assistance. December 10, he accepted the 2020 Nobel Peace Prize on its behalf. How has the pandemic influenced your mission? These are apparently questions of Mr. Beasley. The number of people we project to be on the brink of starvation has gone from around 135 million pre-COVID to 270 million. So 2021 has the potential to be catastrophic. What kind of aid will you need to tackle it? We need $15 billion in 2021. Almost double the $8.4 billion raised this year. That includes $5 billion just to avert famine for about 30 million people, mostly in conflict-affected areas. How do you convince nations to increase aid at a time of global hardship? It is about being strategic with the money they have. It's like the Titanic. You've got spilled wine on the carpet and an iceberg out front. Which do you focus on? You need to focus on famine, destabilization, and mass migration. Joseph Hinks wrote that article. The View essay. What I learned living with my elderly parents for 2 months of the pandemic. By Belinda Luscombe. That's L-U-S-C-O-M-B-E. There's a small inset photo here of three smiling people with a blue sky, a couple of trees, and some white umbrellas behind them. One is an elderly-looking gentleman. Another is a possibly older adult woman. She's wearing big sunglasses. And the other is a slightly younger woman. Well, probably more than slightly younger. It's hard to tell because she's got a stocking cap pulled down pretty far on her face. She's wearing glasses, but not sunglasses. And her smile and that of the older woman next to her are quite comparable. I am not sure how much grown adults should aim to do for their parents as they get older, but I am pretty confident that I have undershot. I am their only daughter, and I've lived in the U.S. for about 28 years longer than I said I would. So during the pandemic, with no office to report to, I moved back to my childhood home in Australia. While in some ways this return was sparked by concerns for the health and safety of my begetters, in others it was a literal guilt trip. One of the things that's shocking about seeing aging parents after a while is how much of their lives looks like it needs fixing. There are all the issues that were beginning to get sticky before the pandemic, plus all the new measures that need to be put in place to keep them safe, plus all the stuff, in some cases piled up boxes of stuff, that worried you for years but became mission critical after COVID-19 meant they had to stay home for months. And even worse, they seem so oblivious to it all. My parents will allow that they move a little slower and don't hear as well as they used to, but they pride themselves on being independent, accomplished 80-somethings. For that which they cannot manage, my brothers step up admirably. But I'm like the frog who's jumped into the pot and noticed how murky the water is. To celebrate my arrival, my mother purchased a 1,000-piece jigsaw puzzle of New York City for us to do. There's no way I'm getting sucked into that, I said to myself. I've got too much to do. I plan to be there for 6 weeks, including 2 spent in Australia's strict hotel quarantine. Even after tacking a few weeks on the end, I could hear the clock ticking. So I bought my mom an updated iPad with more accommodations for her hearing. I got my dad a new phone in order to more effectively shout at him from 10,000 miles away that he's using it wrong. I helped persuade them to have their skinny, cancer-ravaged dog put down. I cleaned furniture and ovens and countertops. I bought them clothes and installed a thingamy to extend the reach of their Wi-Fi. I went with them to medical appointments and discovered my mother was not supposed to be eating sugar and my father was supposed to have a procedure. With a little nudge from me, Dad got a hearing aid and stents put in his heart. For a few weeks, I was a whirlwind of fixingness. My parents saw my exertions as unnecessary, perhaps even disruptive, but they humored my to-do list. After all, it meant I was around the house, and I might pause while downloading Zoom for them so we could meet in real time. There were many mid-chore offers of a cup of tea, and then an hour later of gin and tonic. They wanted to talk to the human they raised, to hear what she really thought, to tell her some old stories. Life report, not life repair. The whole time I was there, I knew that eventually I would have to leave for my other family and that returning to my parents would be difficult and that eventually they will leave the way all humans do and returning to me will be impossible. The pandemic made the reality of these exits hard to ignore. It was obvious that giving more time to talk and less to tasks made sense, but I still found it exasperatingly difficult. Talking's never done. It's hard to differentiate from loafing. And because my parents are a little deaf and forgetful, it often seems like you finish a conversation only to have it all over again. It feels like nothing's been achieved. I know you sometimes have to fix things more than once. Floors are always getting dirty and Wi-Fi goes down, but usually not within the space of 45 minutes. Of course, I did help with the stupid jigsaw puzzle. It turned out to be the perfect excuse to just plonk down and chat. I thought it would be easy, since after almost 30 years of living there, I should know what parts of New York City go where, but it was perplexing. Challenged my perceptions. Took ages. Sometimes the only way to make sense of a picture, even one you think you know well, is to bring all the little bits near each other and sit with them for a while. Here is the page entitled 7 Questions. Steve McQueen is being questioned. He's the Oscar-winning director on his new collection of films, Memories of 1980s London, and The Landscape for Black British Artists. And there's a photo here of him wearing a white T-shirt and a black, or at least very dark-colored jacket. He He's smiling into the camera. He has what appears to be a shaved head, a slight facial growth on his chin and upper lip, and he's wearing glasses. Small axe takes its name from a proverb. If you're the big tree, wear the small axe. It's an anthology of five films about the experiences of the West Indian community in London from the late 1960s to 80s. How did you first conceive the series? Answer, this started about 11 years ago, and I needed the time and the maturity to get a grip on it. I needed that perspective. It was going to be one story with one family, but with my research, I was just finding all these amazing stories and thought they should be standalone stories. These stories are not really taught in school or seen on screen. What was it about these five moments that interested you? Answer, Mangrove was the first story, and it's a landmark case in British history. At the time, it was the longest-running court case at 55 days, and during it, the police were called racist for the first time. Lover's Rock is about the whole idea of another claim of defiance, of being able to express oneself with music in a landscape which was not inviting to black people in the clubs. The idea for Red, White, and Blue emerged from the writer's room. Alex Wheatle was actually a writer in the writer's room, and his story, Alex Wheatle, W-H-E-A-T-L-E, was so amazing, I said, we need your story. With education, I was combining the narrative of educationally subnormal schools, which emerged in the late 60s and 70s, with my own unfortunate situation, which happened in the 80s. You had John Boyega in mind to play a senior police officer in Red, White, and Blue from a very early stage. What was the experience of working with him like? Answer, John can hold the camera. You either have it or you don't, and he has it. When we were making the film, he did that speech at Hyde Park involving Black Lives Matter and the death of George Floyd. I think the project had an influence on him, and then after that speech, he had an influence on the project. There was a real kind of intertwining of real life and art. You grew up in the time period when the anthology takes place. How did your specific memories inform storytelling? Answer, anything a black person did was on the front or the back pages. It was a time where people were treated very badly. I remember the Brixton riots in 81 and walking to school and the narrative that was conjured up at school and the energy that was put upon you when you walked down the street as a black person. There was a lot of uncertainty, but again, we power through. And I owe a great debt to those people who led the way. What do you hope people take away from watching the anthology? Answer, I really hate that question. I don't know. That's not my problem. I never want to put people in a straitjacket. What has been the biggest impact on you from creating these films? Answer, it's been quite heavy. The first word I would say is relief. For me, it's great when people feel themselves looking at themselves, because within the narrative of British films, a lot of these stories have never been told. My ambition was to fill the gap in that narrative. Do you feel like, as a black British creator, the landscape is changing for you to make the art that you want to make? Answer, I'm very hard-headed because of my mother. The landscape's changing because of individuals laying down a path for people to come into, and we did that with small acts. All our departments had at least one or two apprentices. It is changing because we make a change. The whole idea of this series is small acts, meaning do it yourself. No one's going to give it to you. That article was written by Sue Yin Haynes. We'll wind up the hour with a few items from The Best of Culture, the 10 Best Podcasts by Eliana Doctorman. Nice White Parents, Serial Productions takes a fascinating deep dive into New York City public schools, among the most segregated in the U.S. Host Chana Joffe Walt presents a stunning portrait of white parents who often choose their children's future test scores over the diverse community they ostensibly desire. Once you've heard this show, it's difficult to stop thinking about it or debating possible solutions with other listeners. You must remember this. Karina, K-A-R-I-N-A, Longworth's podcast on Hollywood's history produced its strongest miniseries yet on Polly Platt, P-L-A-T-T. Platt is best known as the first wife of director Peter Bogdanovich, an unjust legacy, considering she did much of the work for films like Terms of Endearment and Broadcast News, but received little credit. Sourcing from Platt's unpublished memoir, Longworth gives the overshadowed artist her due and explores a larger story about sexism in cinema. Home Cooking. Podcasting vet Hrishikesh Hirway, H-I-R-W-A-Y, poses listeners' cooking questions to chef and co-host Sami Nosrat, like what to do with dozens of jalapenos in a CSA box. Nosrat's answers are ingenious, and, as anyone who has watched her on Netflix's Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat knows, her laugh's infectious. If we're all stuck at home, we might as well strive to make our time in the kitchen as joyful as possible. We've run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I'm Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have questions or comments, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.